Okay, so I'm going to give a series of lectures about F-theory and elliptic vibrations. And I want them to be accessible to a lot of people, which means that everybody should be bored at some point. So hopefully I will achieve that. If we reach the point where nobody's bored, well, I'm not sure how you're going to know if the other guy is not bored. So I'm not sure how you're going to notify me of that. But anyway, please slow me down if I get going too fast. So I'll start out with a very brief description of where F-theory comes from in physics. So there are various kinds of string theories. And one of the types of string theory, which goes by the name of 2B string theory. Not going to say too much about it, but I will tell you that it has a complex valued scalar field, often described in the physics literature as a pair of real scalar fields, but we can think of it as complex valued, which I'm going to call tau. And the theory has an SL2Z symmetry. And under that symmetry, tau gets mapped to A tau plus B over C tau plus D, the standard linear fractional transformation for A, B, C, D, a 2x2 integer matrix with determinant 1. Okay, so that's sort of one fact that gets people going. There's this complex valued scalar field tau in that theory. By the way, the symmetry is not really PSL2Z, although it looks like it might be from just the tau action, but there is an action on certain fermionic fields in the theory, which includes that minus 1 in some non-trivial way. So the true symmetry of the physical theory is SL2Z. There was a duality proposed a long time ago in string theory. So there's a cousin of string theory known as M-theory. And if you formulate M-theory on a space-time that has a 2 torus as a factor, well, a 2 torus, so M-theory requires, when you're studying it on certain space-times, it requires specifying a metric on the space-time. So this is a 2 torus with a metric. And the key thing about metrics on 2 tori is that they're also so the sort of conformal class corresponds to a complex structure, and that's also often labeled by tau. So that's labeled by some tau in the upper half plane. Oh, I forgot to mention that this tau with the conventions that I'm looking at is confined to the upper half plane, and of course the linear fractional transformations preserve the upper half plane. So there's a metric whose conformal class is labeled by a complex structure or by a tau in the upper half plane, and the proposed duality was that M theory on T2 should be dual to, so produce an isomorphic physics as this type 2B theory on an S1, where, the conformal class is a complex structure plus a volume, I should have mentioned, or an area, I should say. Right, so it's the metrics of area 1 which have a conformal class, which are characterized by this conformal class, which is the complex structure, but you also need to specify an area. And in this correspondence, the area of the T2 goes like the length of the S1, radius of the S1 or diameter of the S1, to something like the minus 4/3. I don't remember the exact power, but it's negative. And the complex structure, tau, corresponds to the scalar field tau in the corresponding type 2B theory. So that the geometric symmetry, so here the complex structure is actually corresponding to tau mod the action of SL2Z, and let me remind you how that happens. So to specify a complex structure on a two torus, I should regard my two torus as being C modulo a lattice, namely modulo some translations by some pair of complex numbers, omega 1 and omega 2. You take linear combinations using integers and generate a lattice in that way. And tau is the ratio, omega 2 over omega 1. So I guess there's some orientation assumption to say that tau is in the upper half plane. And of course, I can change the basis on the lattice. Maybe I should just call this lattice lambda. A change of basis on lambda corresponds to an SL2Z transformation. And since we're getting tau by the ratio, we end up with this linear fractional transformation action on tau. So the known geometric action of SL2Z on tau, thinking of tau as specifying the complex structure, goes over naturally to the expected SL2Z symmetry of the type 2B string theory. So that was one of the checks that this duality made sense. And what you'll notice is that as the area of T2, of the metric on T2 goes to zero, the size of the S1 goes to infinity. And in the limit where the area goes to zero, you should recover the 2B theory. So when I say I'm taking it on a certain compact space, what I really mean is this 2B theory is an 11-dimensional physical theory. This M theory is a 10-dimensional physical theory. This M theory is an 11-dimensional physical theory. What I really mean is that I took this as a direct factor in the total space-time of the theory, and the natural interpretation of having a direct factor of a circle, but that circle becoming infinitely large, is that the circle decompactifies and that you end up with the flat space theory once again. So what's the F-theory idea? So in F-theory, what we want to do is take families of T2s. And correspondingly, we'll take a type 2B theory with a variable tau. And we'll somehow exploit the SL2Z symmetry to get an interesting theory. So there's one more ingredient which comes from physics, which helps to make physical sense of this, which is something called a D7 brain that exists in the type 2B theory. And the only thing I'm going to tell you about D7 brains is, so now I'm going to be studying type 2B compactified on something larger than just S1. I'll typically be studying it on some even-dimensional compact manifold of sufficiently small dimension that there's some leftover space-time, which forms the effective physical theory that people are interested in. The thing I'm going to tell you about the D7 brain is that it's a defect in codimension 2. And so it's some kind of place where where a singularity develops in the space-time that I'm using to compactify the 2B theory. But because it's in codimension 2, I can ask what happens to the fields in the theory when I encircle the codimension 2 defect. And what happens to the fields is that tau goes to tau plus 1 when you keep track of what the fields were doing. So this is part of the SL2Z symmetry. And building models that have these brains, of which there's a natural supergravity description, is something that people were trying to do in the mid-90s, and realized that this provided a really interesting way of doing that. If you could get your hands on families of T2s which had appropriate kinds of defects, which would sort of implement the monodromy, tau goes to tau plus 1 type monodromy, you would potentially be able to discuss a new class of string theory models. So that's the foundation of the F-theory idea. So what we want to do is study, well, from the 2B side, I'm going to be taking either I'll think of 2B on some S, or I can think of it on S minus a defect delta. So whether I consider the defect to be part of spacetime or not sort of depends on my point of view at the moment. Typically, the metric that one puts on S minus delta pushes delta off to infinite distance. So from a metric point of view, delta sort of goes away, and you can do this thing topologically, but you don't ever quite get to the, you have these things with infinite throats, so you don't ever quite get to where the location of the defect is. On the other hand, in my interpretation in terms of families of, of T2s, I'm going to want to consider delta sort of closer by, and I guess the prototype is that I could have a disk with a point, or I could take a Poincaré metric on the complement of that disk with a point, which would cause the point to be at infinite distance, but conformally, the punctured disk is still the punctured disk, and in fact, I'm going to want to extend structures over that point. So I'll typically not remove the delta. Then what I'm going to want is a family over S. So this family should have a nice property over pi over S minus delta, right? So if I describe the entire family, I can restrict that family to the complement of the defect locus. And here it should be just an ordinary T2 fibration of some kind, T2 fiber bundle, let's say. Topologically, but one of the nice things about the theory of two-tori, particularly when I've sort of labeled the metric by this complex structure, is that there are natural compactifications provided by complex geometry or algebraic geometry so that I can discuss X as a complex manifold, S as a complex manifold, pi as a holomorphic map, whose fibers away from delta are always two tori, but whose fibers at delta have some different behavior. And as we'll discuss, the fibers over points of delta help to determine the kind of defect behavior and really enrich this theory in interesting ways.
So should one just think of this as being, you've got this family of
elliptic
curves over S1, and
S is no longer S1. S is a base, right?
S over some base.
Over some base.
They degenerate.
That's right.
You control the degeneration.
That's right. So this is the place where the mathematicians are a little bored, and the physicists. Absolutely. I'm about to run through the sort of correspondence between the holomorphic geometry and the algebraic geometry so that we'll see what the natural way is to compactify these things. But let me just say that in order to preserve supersymmetry in the model, one typically imposes that the total space of X should be Calabi-Yau. So a lot of the discussion does not require the assumption of a Calabi-Yau total space, but at a certain point, in order to preserve supersymmetry, I've cleverly hidden the Calabi-Yau behind the screen. Sorry about that. At a certain point, in order to preserve supersymmetry, we'll want to impose the Calabi-Yau condition on the total space.
Isn't Calabi-Yau's
Calabi-Yau's compact? Calabi-Yau's, so that's a really good question. The total space of this fibration, if I take S to be compact, will itself be compact. And so I can look at compact Calabi-Yaus that way. There is a vast literature talking about non-compact Calabi-Yaus, which is an oxymoron,
right.
But it's an oxymoron which just is in the literature. You can't avoid it anymore. And so though that means a complex manifold with trivial canonical bundle, not necessarily with a Ricci flat metric. And those, for a lot of purposes, are just fine for studying this.
If you wanted to describe your physical space, you need four non-compact dimensions.
That's right. Although in order to get our hands on the properties here, we're going to study bases of various dimensions. So first it'll be real dimension 2, then real dimension 4, and finally real dimension 6, because a lot of the properties of the families can be studied more easily with bases of smaller dimensions. The corresponding physical theory is too high a dimension to be realistic, so the ultimate goal is to understand what happens when S has 6 real dimensions, but along the way, we'll do some other theories. So the story which relates the complex analysis to the algebraic geometry goes back to Weierstrass. And Weierstrass wrote down, Weierstrass asked the question, could you have a way of describing doubly periodic structures in the plane? Where's the one with the formula? So, Weierstrass took this lattice, which was generated by two elements, and asked for doubly periodic functions on C, periodic under shift by omega 1 or shift by omega 2. Now, those functions don't exist if they're required to be holomorphic. The reason is that they'd be bounded, and a bounded holomorphic function is constant. So to get a non-constant function, one wants a non-constant meromorphic function. And Weierstrass wrote down a prototype for this thing, which is called the Weierstrass P function. And the Weierstrass P function has an implicit dependence on the choice of periods. You put a double pole at the origin, and you also put a double pole at every lattice point not at the origin, but to make everything converge, you have to regularize slightly. So you take z minus the location of the pole minus 1 over the corresponding square of the lattice point to get it to behave. And you have to do this and then take the sum, right, to get everything to converge. There's a square there. So that's the Weierstrass P function. If you look at a Laurent expansion of the Weierstrass P function around z equals 0, you discover z to the minus 2 plus, it turns out that the constant terms all go away, and you end up with just two terms that are interesting for my little calculation, called capital G4 and capital G6. So those are the, and this is an even function, by the way, so the Laurent expansion will only involve even powers of z. So the claim is the constant term is 0, which is easy to see, that I'm just picking off the z squared and z fourth terms, and I get O of z to the sixth left over. And the formula for these guys is simple. G2k of omega 1 omega 2 is the sum of mn not equal to 0, 0 of 1 over m omega 1 plus m omega 2 to the 2k, which also converges. So then Weierstrass does this very cute trick, which is if you take that Laurent expansion and you work out 1/2 times the derivative squared, well, let's see, the derivative is going to have a z to the minus 6, and so when you z to the minus it's going to have a 2z to the minus 3, and when you square it, it's going to have a 4z to the minus 6. You subtract off the cube, and that's why I put the 1/2 in there, and then subtract 15 G4 times P and 35 G6. You end up with something that is regular. So this is completely believable that there's some combination like that which has that property, right? If I just start taking some powers here, I can get rid of, by appropriate coefficients, all the negative z's that appeared in the Lorentz expansion. And because it's doubly periodic still and regular is equal zero, it's bounded. And in fact, it vanishes at z equals zero. So it's identically zero. So there's this very nice algebraic equation. By the way, I'm normalizing things slightly different than Weierstrass did. But there's this very nice algebraic, because Weierstrass didn't put this 1/2 here, so he had a 4 here. But anyway, there's this very nice equation of the form y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g. And as I say, traditionally in Weierstrass, the original Weierstrass form, you put the 4 in front of the x cubed, but anyway, we won't do that. You have something of that form where f and g are these explicit functions of the periods omega 1 and omega 2. And this describes, what does it describe? It describes all of the points in C mod lambda. In fact, it describes C mod lambda. So this sitting inside of C2 describes C mod lambda minus the origin, if you like. I guess I should say C minus lambda mod lambda. It's probably a nice way to say it. I'm leaving out those poles, but there's a compactification. So I can think of the compactification naturally as sitting inside of P2 just by compactifying this way inside of CP2, and that adds a single point, which is exactly what you would have expect since you took out one point, and it's in fact non-singular generically. Well, it's non-singular for all the values of the these Eisenstein series, G4 and G6, that correspond, well, but anyway, it's non-singular, let me just say generically. So we start with just a simple problem of how did we possibly write down doubly periodic guys, get something which depends essentially only on tau, and the answer is you get an equation like this. There is a scaling that's possible. So I could rescale x by lambda squared, y by lambda cubed, and then I have to make some scalings of the coefficients. So f would have to scale by lambda to the fourth, and g would have to scale by lambda to the sixth. And that overall scaling preserves the equation. So the f and the g are not individually sort of invariants of the elliptic curve or of the equation, but up to this scaling they are. And that's sort of a source of a lot of nice properties. Okay, so I've gone from complex structure, I sort of quoted the result that metrics on tori were conformal to flat metrics, which were labeled by complex structures. And then I kind of went through how we got something algebraic out of that. And this compactification, the fact that I get this one-point compactification, is exactly how we're going to be able to write expressions which extend to those defects where tau goes to tau plus 1.
Question?
Yes?
So why did we start with 1 over z squared?
I could have started with anything. There are theorems which says that this actually generates the meromorphic functions on the guy. One of the equations that you get is the P prime, which has a 1 over z cubed in it. Instead of a 1 over z squared, p prime is not enough to generate, I mean, you need these two functions to generate, basically, although they're related by this derivative. I think there are lots of other places you could have started. This is just the traditional one. Yes?
What does the algebraic equation in this row have to do with the y standard figure? I missed something.
Sorry. I'm setting x to p and y to p prime.
Oh, okay. Got it.
I forgot to say that.
So these Weierstrass functions are just one example?
Weierstrass functions, if you like, they're one example, but now you can go backwards and you can show that this guy, the complex solutions to this guy, I should say that. So if I take my projective version of the equation, this defines, so the set of these guys in CP2 defines an elliptic curve, something with a complex structure, which is topologically C mod Z2. And if I calculate the period integrals of an appropriate holomorphic one form on this guy, which I can write as dx over y in affine coordinates, I can choose the gamma 1 and gamma 2 so that omega 1 is this and omega 2 is this. There's probably some scale factor that I'm forgetting.
But F and G specifically G4 and G6.
So in this case, F and G are specifically 15G, yeah. Minus 15, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. But they're only well defined up to scaling. But as I say, you can sort of get back the, if you choose a basis for the first homology, so for the loops on the torus, then you can get back the periods which were generated the Eisenstein series to begin with. So that's sort of the dictionary. And now what we want to do is study cases where we're going to allow F and G to be essentially functions, I'll explain why it's in quotes in a second, on this base. And then we can write equations like y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g to define whole families of these T2s, where now they'll depend on some f and g, which are somehow functions on the base. So being functions on the base really means that I have a map, in some sense, from S to it's a little more information than just the tau in the upper half plane because of this scaling business. So I have some kind of, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. But this is the basic idea that I should be able to describe the variable family now in terms of data of F and G chosen on the base, again up to some appropriate scaling of those things. So in this period interpretation, I should explain that the upper half plane, which contained tau, has the nice action of SL2Z on it, and there's this picture, which many people have seen, which shows a fundamental domain for the action of SL2Z. And this fundamental domain takes advantage, this is 1 half and minus 1 half, it takes advantage of the tau goes to tau plus 1 symmetry, which corresponds to 1101 in SL2Z. And the location of the defect is really up here as you approach imaginary infinity. So what I want to do is take the imaginary part of tau goes to infinity. And if I want to do that and then write what I've got in terms of something which is invariant under that tau goes to tau plus 1 symmetry, the easy thing to do is to introduce Q, which is e to the 2 pi I tau, which is naturally invariant under the tau goes to tau plus 1 symmetry, and which has the property that Q goes to 0 as the imaginary part of tau goes to infinity. So if I just ignore the other part of the group and just take the subgroup generated by this guy, so the fundamental domain for that would be an infinite strip in the plane, and then do this exponentiation. Well, sorry, I'm only in the upper half plane. Do the exponentiation, I would end up with a disk, and the Q coordinate, Q equals 0 would be here, And the effect of the defect that I was talking about is going around this disk once, which increases tau by 1. So the center of such a disk in this Q-plane should be the location of a D7 brain from the physical interpretation. And when we build models like this, which will have natural real codimension 2 defects in the base, we'll identify, well, when the defect is exactly doing tau goes to tau plus 1, we'll identify that defect with the presence of a 7 brain that has to be added to the physical theory in order to produce the compactification. So our program now is to try to understand families like this described by algebraic equations, by algebraic geometry, treat those algebraic equations over the complex numbers for the most part, but for some number theorists in the audience, I will definitely talk about other situations which are actually related to how we study these things. So it's not always just going to be thinking of them as complex numbers. Interpret the essentially q equals 0 points in the upper, in the compactified upper half plane, compactified upper half plane mod SL2Z, as corresponding to where these brain defects would be inserted into the physical theory. So in algebraic geometry, the key property that C mod lambda has is it's a curve, which means Riemann surface. Sorry. There's this little problem, which is that there's real dimension and complex dimension floating around in this story, and I'm going to go back and forth and occasionally not warn you that I've done so between real and complex dimension. But so C is a curve over the complex numbers, it's a complex algebraic curve of genus 1. And that's the starting point in algebraic geometry. In fact, I can regard an entire family, if it's described algebraically, as giving me information about a genus 1 curve. And I do that in the following way. So S is going to be some algebraic variety in all of my examples. And what that means is that it's defined by some equations in some projective space, polynomial equations in some projective space. And similarly, X is going to be an algebraic variety. And the fact that I have a description of a map from one to the other means that I have some kind of algebraic way of expressing this algebraic variety in terms of algebraic coordinates, locally defined, well-defined algebraic functions on that algebraic variety. And there's a cute trick, which is to look at the meromorphic functions on S. Well, I should call them rational functions on S, ratios of polynomial functions on S, and consider X as a curve, an algebraic curve over the field, and so X is not equal to, but corresponds to, an algebraic curve over the field of rational functions on X. So, on S, excuse me. So my typical picture here is that I'm choosing f and g to somehow be functions on S, and now I'll just forget about the fact that they're nice, regular, well-defined functions on S, and I'll think of them as rational functions on S. The field of rational functions on an algebraic variety, excuse me, the set of rational functions on an algebraic variety forms a field, and one of the great things about modern algebraic geometry is that whatever we can do, generally speaking, we can do over any field. So we're not confined to the complex numbers. We can study genus 1 curves over a field capital K. So I'm not going to get full information about X by thinking of the genus 1 curve over the field capital K, but I can get a lot of the information about X by studying it as a field in that way. In particular, since I'm interested in the defects of this elliptically fibered guy, it turns out that when there's a defect of real codimension 2 in this complex setting, there's some natural function on the base which vanishes at the defect but is non-vanishing away from the defect, locally defined. And if I sort of pay attention to the part of the family that has to deal with that function, then I can get information on the behavior of X near that defect, and that information will turn out to be enough to determine this monodromy behavior, the behavior of tau, as you encircle the defect. So I've just given you a sort of preview of something called the Kodaira classification of singular fibers in codimension 1, and that's what we use to figure out not only which kinds of elliptic fibrations correspond to the single D7 brain that I mentioned, but to other kinds of possible defects as well, including some which were not envisioned when the 2B theory with brains was first written down. So that's one of the interesting things that F-theory does for us. It actually gives us a much broader class of physical theories than we might have dreamed up had we only been studying the type 2B theory with brains to begin with. So I'm interested in genus 1 curves over a field K, and apologies to the number theorist, the characteristic of K is 0. That just lets me... well, anyway. lets me complete the square and complete the cube when I feel like it. I think characteristic K not equal to 2 or 3 would probably suffice for almost everything I'm going to say. Pardon? Yeah. So what am I going to do with a genus 1 curve over a field K? Well, I can use some tools from algebraic geometry. Which probably everybody has heard of in some form. And in particular, I'm going to use something called the Riemann-Roch theorem. But if you've studied the Riemann-Roch theorem, sorry, maybe I should just do a sanity check. How many people have not heard of the Riemann-Roch theorem? Okay. So the Riemann-Roch theorem is a theorem about algebraic curves. And it says if I have an algebraic curve and if I have a divisor on that curve. So a divisor means a linear combination of points with integer coefficients. And I ask myself how many D primes are there? I consider the space of D primes, which are the sum of NP prime P, with a property that D minus D prime is the zeros minus poles of a meromorphic function, and the NP primes are all non-negative. These are just coefficients of D prime. If I consider that space and call that H naught of O of D, then the Riemann-Roch theorem gives me a formula for the dimension of that space minus the dimension of a related space where I take the zeros of a meromorphic one form minus D. And it tells me that the answer is the degree of D, sorry, I should have defined that, degree of D is the sum of the NPs the degree of D minus the genus plus 1. So that's a basic tool that I'm going to use. There are lots of ways of proving this thing. Over the complex numbers, it's some version of the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. Well, sorry. The Atiyah-Singer index theorem is some vast generalization of this, but I say it in those terms because lots of physicists know something about the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. But there are algebraic proofs, and it's true even over non-algebraically closed fields, such as the function field of this base that I want to use for my elliptic vibrations. So this referred to points. Over non-algebraically closed field, the notion of a point is slightly tricky, and I don't exactly want to go into that today, or maybe ever. But what I want to do is, for my first version of this analysis, is I want to assume that C has a point, P and C. And let me just observe that the types of equations I've been looking at, y squared z equals x cubed plus fxz squared plus gz cubed inside CP2, always have the point 0, 1, 0 in homogeneous coordinates on them. So there are more general genus 1 curves, and it's important, particularly in work in progress I'm doing with Volker Brown about F theory for genus 1 vibrations instead of elliptic vibrations, to look at those, and we will at some point in these lectures, but for today I'm going to assume that there's a point. So if I assume that there's a point, then I'm going to consider a sort of sequence of these divisors. That's what the linear combinations of points were called. I'm going to consider divisors which are given by multiples of the point. So this was previously our example, right? I mean, we got to a specific equation representing an elliptic curve by recapitulating the Weierstrass theory. Now I'm actually talking a little more abstractly about curves of genus 1. I want to do that over arbitrary fields, which could include the field of rational functions on some base that I'm using to make a family. But I want to go through, accepting this Riemann-Roch theorem, I want to go through and find the form of that the answer has to take, but it does require the existence of this point. So what do I do? Let's look at zeros of a meromorphic function, one form. A meromorphic one form on C has equal numbers of zeros and poles. In fact, there's a holomorphic one form which is non-vanishing. And because of that holomorphic one form being non-vanishing, this is actually like H naught of O of minus D. So if I have a D of positive degree, then there's a chance of finding representatives in which all the NPs are non-negative. But if I have a D of negative degree, there's no chance of finding a representative for which all the NPs are non-negative. So this term in the Riemann-Roch theorem vanishes in that particular case. So I really get this nice formula, degree minus genus plus 1. Genus is 1, so it's degree D. So the key thing I'm going to use is that the dimension of H naught of D is the degree of D in these particular cases. So H naught of O of P has a single section, which I'm going to call W. Sorry, I'm choosing a basis of that space, and I'll make any choice I like and call it W. Then I have H naught of O of 2P, and One of the things that it has in it already is W squared. So let's see. Rats. Oh, rats. Well, this is the projectivization of this guy. I defined a linear system, not the space of sections, accidentally. So what I really want What I really want is the meromorphic function that it is the zeros minus poles of. That's what I want, and this should be this way if I'm doing it that like that. So this is supposed to be a vector space, and I didn't actually write it as a vector space. I gave them, yeah. Anyway, I'm trying to avoid teaching an entire one semester course in algebraic geometry tonight. So this is a slight confusion, because the actual elements of these spaces are locally defined functions. Rather than divisors themselves, and the zeros of those locally defined functions are the divisors that I was looking at. Okay, so here I have a locally defined function which is a section of this line bundle. Sorry, I didn't use that language, but I have a locally defined function belonging to this divisor, and the square of that locally defined function belongs to O of 2p. So that's generally true, that multiplying the various functions together gives me elements of the corresponding divisors, where the divisors got added. This is a two-dimensional space, so it has a second section, and I'm going to call that section, second element, I'm going to call it X. So X is only well-defined up to linear combinations of X and W squared, essentially. But anyway, I get a second section. For 3P, I still have W cubed, I have WX from before, and it's supposed to be three-dimensional, so I need another one, Y. For 4P, I'm going to stop very soon. For 4P, I get these, and I also have X squared, so I'm done, I don't need anything new. For 5P, I get W to the fifth, W cubed X, W squared Y, WX squared and XY to get something of degree 5. And now for 6, this is where it gets fun. I get W to the 6th, W to the 4th X, W cubed Y, W squared X squared, WXYZ, and two new guys, X cubed and Y squared. And that's 7 elements in a 6-dimensional space, so there has to be a relation among these guys. So I get an equation just from the assumption of having a genus 1 curve and a point on it. It's not hard to show that the coefficients of x cubed and y squared in this equation have to be non-zero. And it's then not hard to show that there's a scaling of the variables that you could do to make each of those coefficients to be 1. So I end up with an equation of the following form. Y squared plus A1YW plus A3, I guess that would be A3 then. A1XYW plus A3YW cubed is equal to X cubed plus A2X squared W squared plus A4X to the XW to the 4th plus A6W to the 6th. Where I simply use the subscript to label the degree in W of this thing. And that defines a curve in what's known as a weighted projective space with weights 1, 2, and 3. So I give Y weight 3, I give X weight 2, and I give W weight 1, and then you'll see that each monomial in that equation has degree 6, has weight 6. So that defines my elliptic curve in that space. If I set W equal to 1, so that's some affine chart in this projective space, then I get the same affine equation. Well, you'll see in a second. I get the same affine equation as we got in Z equal 1 here. It's two different ways of completing the same equation. But this is the one that kind of naturally comes from this analysis with the sections of different bundles. So that looks like a lot of parameters. And in characteristics away from 2 and 3, I can now do the following trick. First, I complete the square here. So if I complete the square, then I get a new y is equal to, I guess, x stays as it was, but with new coefficients, x squared w squared plus a4 tilde xw to the fourth plus a6 tilde w to the sixth. And now I can complete the cube here. Sorry, maybe not everybody knows how to complete the cube. Completing the square means I've got quadratic and linear, and then I take half of the coefficient of the linear and add the square of that on both sides of the equation, I get a square, right? For completing the cube, what I want to do is make a substitution for x which incorporates one-third of the coefficient of x squared so that the resulting guy has no x squared term. So all I can do is get rid of the x squared term. I'm still stuck with both an x and a constant, but it means that I've rewritten it in the form x cubed plus fx tilde plus g for appropriate constants f and g. So the f and the g are completely determined by this guy, and again, away from characteristics 2 and 3, I'm able to put the entire equation into this form. So I know I started there, but the point I was trying to make was that if you start in a very general situation, imagining using this idea of genus 1 fibered, or in this case, because it has a point, elliptically fibered algebraic variety as determining anyway, when you have such a guy, you end up with an equation of this form where f and g are now appropriate constants. They should be thought of in the context I just described as meromorphic functions on the base, capital S, and in fact, more generally, I can think of them as sections of line bundles on capital S, but I'm trying not to use line bundle technology, at least in this first lecture.
Question?
Yes.
So, we first considered the torus as the complex plane divided by a lattice.
Right.
Is that the same as a genus 1 curve with a point?
Yes, if you, that's right. So the complex plane divided by a lattice has a natural choice of point, namely the origin in the complex plane. And there's another way of saying it in which you sort of wouldn't have chosen that point. If you make families in which you haven't chosen the point, then you end up not having a Weierstrass equation. Exactly. We'll get to that. It is possible for there to be a family not without a point being chosen. In fact, there are simple equations that you can write down which describe plane curves, say, over the rational numbers, which have no solution over the rational numbers, but are genus 1 curves.
Right. This isn't going to happen over C, right?
Pardon?
It's not going to happen
over C. No, over C, I can always choose a point. I mean, it's a complex curve, so there's a point. I just choose it, right? But over the rational numbers, there might not have been a point. Or over one of these function fields of the base, there might not have been a point.
So what is the difference between the two? I mean, so now we got a different equation in P1, 2, 3, and again.
Well, in the first instance, I had a single curve, and I had data which was calculated directly from the periods of the lattice, and I used that data to generate two numbers, f and g, which describe the equation. In the second iteration, I took what was potentially a family of curves. I treated that family of curves as being described by quantities that were that could be thought of as rational functions on the base, not constants. And then I derived a similar sort of equation, but now the f and g aren't constants anymore. They're locally defined functions on the base, which describe the entire family. So I've sort of re-arrived at the Weierstrass equation, but with a different meaning of what f and g are. Okay, so I want to quickly explain where are the singular fibers, where are the defects. And that's pretty easy to see from the form of this equation. So if I have an equation of this form, y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g, and I want to know for which values of f and g is this not a non-singular genus 1 curve, well, to be completely careful, I should also worry about the point at infinity, but that turns out not to be an issue. The issue turns out to be in the finite plane here. And all I have to do is take the partial derivative. So 2y has to vanish. 3x squared plus f has to vanish. And then we need a condition which tells us when those two polynomials in f share a common root. And there are various ways of deriving it. The sort of modern thing to do is to go through the Grobner algorithm, which is good cultural knowledge for everybody. So you look for the highest terms, and you figure out what to multiply each equation by in order so that when you subtract, the highest terms would have gone away, right? So if I do that, 3 times this minus x times this, I get 3fx minus fx, so that's 2fx plus 3g. And I can use that lower degree equation to replace this higher degree equation. So now I do it again with this one and this one. And this time I have to multiply here by maybe 2f and this by 3x and then subtract. So 6x squared minus 6x squared goes away and I get 2f squared minus 9xg, except I really should write it minus nxg plus 2f squared to keep things in order. Now I have two more. I can eliminate the x by multiplying the first one by 9 g and the second one by 2f and subtract and adding, sorry. And what I'm left with is 27g squared plus 4f cubed. So that's the expression in the coefficients which describes whether or not this is a non-singular curve for the number theorists present. I do apologize that the F-theory literature has adopted this form of the equation and this normalization of the discriminant, which is great away from 2 and 3, but not good at probably 2. Certainly not good at 2 and maybe also not good at 3. So
why don't you just write down the discriminant to begin with instead of just going through all of that?
How would I have known it?
Well, you've got a cubic there.
Okay, so I could have just written the discriminant of this cubic equation. That's right. Two roots coming together of the cubic equation.
Yeah, and you just want to avoid that.
That's right, which is up to normalization, the same thing that I've just written down. Right. Anyway, there they are. So my picture now is that I have f and g appropriately defined, appropriate locally defined functions on S. So the way I'm describing my pi x to S is by means of f and g, which are locally defined on S. In fact, they're sections of line bundles appropriately thought of, and but I won't try to describe that aspect of it today. And then I have this quantity, delta. I'm using the same letter for two meanings. The particular expression, which is a section of a line bundle, and I also use delta to denote the zeros of delta, which is the defects. So what we need is an understanding of how those defects, so the defects are defined by a single equation on S, And what we want to know, so a single equation on S defines a so-called divisor on S, right? In terms of the whatever the coordinates are on S, it's complex codimension 1, but it actually may have a number of components, and our task is to figure out what happens near each of those components. Because near a component is exactly, as I explained, where you're expecting to find some non-trivial monodromy on the tau, some non-trivial use of the SL2Z symmetry in the type 2B theory. And if it's of that simple kind, tau goes to tau plus 1, then it's simply a D7 brain. But if that were the only story, then everything would have been properly defined on my disk, right, where I just modded out by Q goes to Q plus 1, rather than on the entire upper half plane mod SL2Z. But we really do need that full SL2Z symmetry, both to describe models in geometry and also to fully understand the physical models. So I think I'll close today by telling you what the answer is, and then we'll try to understand why that's the answer next time. So answer V1, which is Kodaira Neron somehow. And I'm going to describe the answer in terms of the Weierstrass equations. So the behavior, there's the Kodaira notation, which will start my little list. There's F, G, and delta. And what I need to tell you is how F, G, or delta vanishes along this component of the defect locus that I'm interested in. So I'm going to look near T equals 0, and I'm going to ask, what's the order of vanishing at T equals 0 of F or G or delta? So that's what I'm going to record in my table here, is an order of vanishing of F, G, or delta. And then I'm going to tell you, the mathematicians the codimension 2 singularity in the total space, and I'm going to tell the physicists the brain behavior.
So what's T?
T is a local parameter for the divisor at a generic point. And then in V2, we have to take into account the fact that things might be not algebraically closed. So, that's the contribution of Tate to this story. So, in the Kodaira notation, first of all, I have non-singular fibers. Those are places where this does not vanish. And here, I have no restriction on order of vanishing. The only thing I care about is that delta, which was measuring the defect locus, doesn't vanish. These are orders of vanishing. And there's no codimension 2 singularity, and there's no brain. Nothing to say. Actually, that looks like a picture, so maybe a dash is better. Now I can have I sub n. So I sub n has a order of vanishing of delta of degree n, and these are zero. So I'm not allowed to have any zero of F or any zero of G. And what I mean is F cannot vanish identically all along the curve, and G cannot vanish identically all along the curve. There will be points at which F vanishes or at which G vanishes. Sorry, when I say curve, I'm thinking of S being a surface. For the physical situation, S is complex dimension 3. It's a real 6 manifold. These guys are real complex surfaces, and there are 3 codimensions to worry about. Lots of interesting stuff to extract from this picture. But right now, I'm interested just in the general point along here. So the codimension 2 singularity is known as an AN minus 1 singularity. And the corresponding... Maybe I should say what the monodromy is. because that tells us something about the brain behavior. So there's no monodromy here, but here the monodromy is 1N01, and the interpretation of the brains is a stack of N coincident D7 brains. So this generalizes the N equal 1 case that I started out with to another case that's standard for brains. In Kodaira's analysis, if F or G vanishes, he discovers that there is a different kind of behavior, and because of the formula, delta equals 4F cubed plus 27G squared, if one of them vanishes, if delta's vanishing, then one of F or G vanishing means the other one has to vanish. But because they have different powers, there are going to be different orders of vanishing of F and G, which are in control at any given moment. So I'm going to leave out V2 because I'm not going to get there to it.
So for the I1 though, because even though you think of that as a D7 brain, you shouldn't associate that necessarily with the V1 gauge symmetry, right? Something that was fusion.
For an IN locus, you don't necessarily have a U1 associated with that IN. For example, in the compactification on an elliptically fibered K3, there are 24 brains, and so you might have thought there were 24 U1s, generically speaking, but in fact there are only 20, right? And so the analysis of the U1, the question of where are the U1s and what do they mean is a pretty subtle one.
Yeah, I just know that when a lot of people are looking at global stuff in 2008, people would misidentify the I1 focus sometimes with the U1 symmetry rather than just say it's a D7 brain where a string can.
That's right, the U1s, I think, are not even now fully understood how to read all the U1s. So let me just quickly finish my table, and then I'll finish for the day. So so there's this collection 2, 3, and 4. By the way, I learned from oral tradition to read this as I sub n and then 2, 3, and 4. I don't think that's logical, but that was what I was taught. So here I have at least 2, and this is a 1, and here I have 2, and this is at least 2. And then we go to I0 star. Oh, and there's no singularity here. There's an A1 and an A2. And the monodromies, sorry, I'm not prepared for the monodromies, but these are not usual monodromies, and these are exotic. I apologize for not having the full table at hand right this second. Here I have 6, at least 3, and at least 2. At least 2 and at least 3. And I have a D4 singularity. And I have a -1, -0, -1, and the interpretation here is an orientifold plane plus 4 D7 brains, which is what you need to cancel the charge. And then here I have IN star, which is exactly 2, exactly 3, N plus 6, D 4 plus N, -1, N 0, -1, and O7 plus 4 plus N D7s. So the D7 and O7 ones were sort of understood. And then I have 3 more exotic guys, 4 star, 3 star, and 2 star. And then I have the famous line in the table called non-minimal, which I'll explain in just a second. So these are 8, 9, 10, 4, 3, 5, and then whatever I need. I think this is 3, this is 4, 5 maybe, and this is 4. And then the non-minimal is at least 4, at least 6, and at least 12. So in the non-minimal case, it turns out that there's a singularity which is kind of a bad singularity, and you have to make local changes of coordinates to sort of cope with it. But these are the famous ADE singularities called E6, E7, and E8, and they have some monodromy, which I forgot to look up, and they have some exotic brain behavior here. So the non-minimal is a signal that the choice of defining equation for the family is not ideal from the point of view of analyzing these guys, and you can get another family which is birational to the first one, which does satisfy, I mean, you know, doesn't get you to this non-minimal line. It's called a minimal Weierstrass model. And so we don't consider that last case. So the interesting thing that happens from the physics point of view is that, just as expected, from the a stack of brains or a stack of brains plus an orientifold, you get unitary or orthogonal groups, which are labeled by these same numbers. You can also get the exceptional groups, E6, E7, and E8, from this construction, as well as exotic ways of obtaining SU2 and SU3 in terms of the compact groups. So one of the interesting features of this story is that there is an enhanced non-abelian gauge symmetry which is present, which comes from the existence of these codimension 2 singularities in the Kodaira table. The V2 is when the base is big enough, there can actually be some monodromy of the components of the singular fiber which are occurring here, so that instead of getting exactly the ADE gauge groups, you might get gauge groups corresponding to non-simply laced Dinkin diagrams. But I think, you know, I didn't have time to do that today, so I'll try to do that in the next lecture. Next lecture is either November 16th or November 30th, depending on an unknown item in my schedule. I will let everybody know. Any questions?
So for the IN star, it starts with SO8, not, it starts with
D4. Starts with D4. Yes.
So what's the meaning of there not being a singularity in the case 2?
Okay, so this is actually a singularity of the total space. So in this particular case, the picture is that the elliptic curve is coming along and it's got some cycle on it, and that cycle shrinks to zero size, which gives you a picture like this. So this cycle kind of pinched off. But it did it in such a way in the family that you created no singularity in the total space. So it's the singularities in the total space in that Weierstrass family which cause the enhanced gauge symmetry and lead to a Dinkin diagram like this. Other questions?
Yeah, how do you avoid that last line in your table, given that, you know, if your base is sufficiently large, you can't choose a global minimum?
If my base is sufficiently large,
well,
I can't.
I mean, you can't always choose a globally minimal. I mean, if you have a you can't always choose a
minimal is minimal Weierstrass, not birationally minimal. Right.
Yeah, but you can't, I mean, it's not always possible to choose a globally
Why not?
Global Weierstrass equation. At least, I mean, certainly not if you're working with a family over some ring of integers, a class number bigger than one, say. I mean, in general, a globally minimal Weierstrass model won't exist.
Ah. Let's see. S was a complex variety.
Its
ring of integers.
Over a complex variety, can you always choose?
Well, I guess what I'm doing is I'm assuming that I've got F and G as sections of appropriate powers of a line bundle. Right, the tensor 2 or 3. And then the geometric construction is, if you run into something non-minimal, then you just tensor that line bundle with O of minus this component. And that reduces the order of pole by exactly what you needed to reduce it by.
But it might mess you up somewhere else.
I see, globally.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Um,
No, sorry. Right. So I certainly have to assume that S is factorial.
Okay.
I think that's enough. I think that at each place I can ask, you know, what's the order of vanishing of F, G, and delta, and I can reduce by twisting the bundle.
At each place, yes, but yeah. You wouldn't be able to do it globally, right?
Well, but if it's factorial, then I have a... we should discuss this later.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes?
Two questions about the table. So is there a reason why as the rank of these 60, 78 went up, the numbers went down?
Why 2-star, 3-star, 4-star were chosen that way?
Yeah.
There is an explanation, and the explanation has to do with the description of these three and these three, and actually also this one, as quotients by finite group actions. So I could take a trivial family of elliptic curves. I could take an elliptic curve across a disk, and I could act by Zn by multiplication by root of unity on the disk, and I'm taking in these cases a special elliptic curve, either j equals 0 or j equals 1728, so that I have an automorphism of it. Or in this case, I'm doing Z2, and I'm just doing the standard minus 1 automorphism. And then I take the quotient by that. Now, there are two choices, because I get to act, having chosen the automorphism on the elliptic curve, I can either go one way or the other way on the disk. And those two choices pair up, the 2 with the 2-star, the 3 with the 3-star, and the 4 with the 4-star. So that's why the notation is parallel.
Okay. Thank you. And for the E6078, the monodromies are known, right?
Yeah, they're known. I intended to print out a page from some paper of mine that had this table so that I could copy the monodromies, and I forgot to do that. And I only realized as I was writing the monodromies that I didn't know what they were.
So the rest of it was from memory, you're saying?
Oh, yeah. The rest, these are, yeah. No, that's easy. Because I do these all the time, yes, absolutely. But I don't use the monodromies directly very often. All right, I will stop here.